Eight?
Yeah.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Business and Transportation, and I am your chair for the day. And so, Mr. Bender, where are we?
Mr. Chair, if you could please open a public hearing on House Bill 5025.
It's done.
Okay. We are continuing today the public hearing on the budget of the Oregon Business Development Department. They have two more days to go. They are now ready to begin discussions of the business finance programs. If you go back to Monday's OLIS meeting date, you'll find their presentation there. And I believe they are now up to slide 83. So if you're looking for the actual page number, if you go to 83, you'll see what's on the screen right now. So I believe that the director, or perhaps just...
Mr. Harder?
There we go.
Welcome again.
Thank you, Chairman Monroe, committee members. We're going to jump right into our business finance section, so I'm going to turn it over to John Saris, who's the manager of that division.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman Monroe, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Saris, and I'm the finance manager at Business Oregon. As I begin today's presentation today, I just wanted to first acknowledge some of the observation and remarks that Co-Chair Gomberg raised on Monday regarding the delinquency and default on some of the loan programs. I know that the chairs may be in and out today, and we'll address those at whatever the pleasure of the committee is. So today, I'll begin with providing an overview of the business finance programs that we administer at Business Oregon. As we indicate on the slides here, we have a couple of different types of programs that we administer. There are really three primary groups. We have direct loans, we have loan insurance, and then we have what are called private activity bonds. The programs that we discuss today have been in existence for about 25 or more years, and there's a couple of primary activities that these programs were designed to do. The first activity is to leverage and not supplant private capital to support business growth, promote geographically diverse investments, and help make loans that put companies in a good, viable financial position. While we go through these programs, it's important to note that the loans are not forgivable. They're typically secured by assets, and they're guaranteed by the business owners. It's also important to note that direct loan and loan insurance programs were developed to help borrowers that typically are not eligible to receive conventional private financing. And as such, these are higher risk loans that we are making. As we get started today, we'll talk about direct loans first. The direct loan programs that we administer are a lot like a loan that an individual would get as, buying a home or a car. When they receive a loan, the applicant receives a loan, they're responsible to make principal and interest payments back to the fund. And when those funds are received, the state can then redeploy those in new projects in the future. The department services loans throughout the entire process. That includes the application that the borrower would submit. We underwrite each individual transaction, document the terms and conditions of the loan. We fund the project, we collect the payments, and if there is a default, we liquidate whatever assets are available to secure the loan and pursue all remedies allowed by law. So the first program that we're going to talk about is one of Oregon's oldest programs. It's the Oregon Business Development Loan Fund. This was established by the state legislature in 1983, and the principal purpose of the program was to provide financial support to traded sector companies across the state. This program in particular provides gap financing to help fund projects, and the projects vary. They could be for land, equipment, working capital, a number of different things, but again, they have to be used for business purposes. The program fills a gap. Usually what you have is you have a lender, a primary lender, a private lender, that's able to provide a good portion of the lending, usually more than 50%. Then the state would be able to provide a loan, typically up to about 40% of the total project cost. And then we usually look for borrower equity to fill the remaining 10%. And so that's the type of structure that we have with this particular program.
Chair.
Representative Meek.
Thank you, Chair. Just clarification question. When we get involved in these loans, what position does Oregon take, as in the seniority of the loans, first or second position?
Chairman Rowe, members of the committee, Representative Meek, the position of the state is usually a junior position to the senior lender. So we're typically subordinate to them. There are instances when we partner with other public lenders, like local economic development groups, we usually share a collateral position in those instances.
Follow up, Chair. And then related to how many projects do you think that you've had to foreclose upon or go through that process over the year, maybe last 5 years, if any?
Chair, members of the committee, currently we have about, I would say, 5 or 6 loans that we have made in about the last 7 or 8 years that are in some type of default, and we are going through liquidation proceedings on those. As a percentage, typically what we're looking at is a default rate of usually about 10%, and then the loss rate of the program is historically between 1 and 2%. So it is a relatively low loss rate, and we are obviously very conscientious about getting the funds back to the state.
Thank you, Chair.
So, again, terms on the loan. We typically can provide up to 40% financing. The loan size varies. Usually it varies between $50,000 and $1 million on a project. The terms of the loan that are repaid are based on the purpose of the financing. So for equipment, we're typically a 7 to 10 year repayment term. On real estate, we can typically go out to about 20 years. Okay, our next slide here does show some of the business activity in 2016. As you can see, we funded 14 loans totaling about $5 million, helping leverage $22.5 million of private funding. The companies are projected to create or retain about 200 jobs, and about 80% of loans were made outside of the Portland metro market. If you do the quick math, the average loan size for a loan that we made was about $350,000. An example that we did fund recently was a company that was located in LeGrand called Outdoor RV. The Business Oregon Development Department partnered with Wells Fargo. We provided a $400,000 loan as part of a $1.4 million expansion. That particular project allowed the company to add $20,000 of manufacturing space, and they projected to create 18 jobs as a result of the investment. So the next program that we'll talk about is another direct loan program, a little bit different from the first one. The Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund can fund really the entire project, so we're not required to have another private lender in the program. This particular program really is a micro-lending program, and it's designed to start early-stage businesses. One of the eligibility criteria is that they have less than $500,000 in sales at the time of application. So, again, very small companies. I would say about 60% of the companies that receive a loan through this program are startups, so fresh businesses getting their doors opened up. The intent of the program, this program was created in 1991, was really to help fund business opportunities as a result of mill closures that were occurring at the time. The department, in order to ensure that the projects are successful, partner with technical assistance providers that work with the businesses before applying to the program. The purpose behind this is that we want to ensure that these small businesses are doing the right kind of research to ensure that they have a business plan, a viable business model, they understand their markets and their risks prior to applying to the state. We don't want to fund a project that has a high probability of failure. So we work with partners around the state, small business development centers, SCORE chapters, Oregon Association of Minority Entrepreneurs, Hispanic Chamber, et cetera, to work with these businesses to ensure that they are prepared for a loan. When we do make a loan,
Representative Reardon has a question.
Thank you, Chair. Do you have a breakdown of the demographics of the borrowers?
Chair, members of the committee. Demographics meaning ethnicity?
Ethnicity, or gender, all those things.
We voluntarily collect that information. It's, I would say it's collected on about a 30 or 40% of loans. I would estimate that a majority of the loans are made primarily to Caucasians. The gender does vary pretty widely. We do service women and men applicants into the program.
Okay, thank you.
Additional?
Well, I just want, can we, is there a way to beef up this collection of this data? I think it'd be really helpful.
Chair, members of the committee, absolutely. We do request or ask for the information on the application. According to federal lending laws, that information is not mandatory. Okay. It's voluntarily provided. So we do, just so that the committee is aware, we work very commonly and often with disadvantaged communities with the program. We do a lot of outreach, specifically making the program available and sharing information with disadvantaged communities.
Okay, great. Thank you,
Chairman.
Representative Meek.
Thank you, Chair. Related to that, it says here you have preference given to rural and distressed areas. How do you define the distressed areas? Because I believe Representative Reardon, I think as part of his district, would be very qualified for that. And want to see what kind of programs you might be for outreach out there.
Representative Meek, members of the committee. The department does designate what a distressed area is. We have an economist that actually works on that particular formula. I really don't know all of the variables that go into it, but I believe it's unemployment rate, average wage, possibly foreclosure rate, things like that in the local economy. We could get back to you on those.
That'd be helpful if we could get some information on. Thank you very much. Thank you, Chair.
Good question.
All right, so moving on. So typical loan size that we see in this particular program is about $50,000. And again, we tie the repayment of the loans to the purpose of the loan. So if it's equipment, again, 5 to 7 years typically for the term of repayment. Rates for the program are very favorable. They're prime plus two. So right now you're looking at about a 5.5% interest rate that does help out. During the last fiscal year, we have closed 8 loans, leveraged about $1.2 million in private financing. One interesting statistic for this program is at the time of the application, applicants had 1 employee and projected to create 4 new jobs. An example of this, we recently funded a project for Benny's Donuts in Benton County, sorry. The gentleman who started this particular business used a family recipe to start making donuts, and his business model was to work with a closed restaurant after hours to make the donuts and distribute them. His peak hours were between 10 p.m. and 3 a.m. At Oregon State. And there was quite a bit of demand, so he approached the state for a loan. We approved a $25,000 loan, helped him open a storefront downtown. Since August, the company's seen a 600% growth in sales and grown from 3 employees to 8 employees. So that's kind of a typical project that we may see with this particular program.
You didn't bring any samples?
Maybe we can have them come back tomorrow. So that does conclude our direct loan portion of the programs that we have. I did want to pause here if we did have any questions. Co-Chair Gomberg, I see that you're back. We acknowledge that you had some observations regarding the delinquency report, and at your pleasure, whenever, we'd be happy to answer those.
Mr. Acting Chairman, do you think we can get into that a little bit right now?
Sure. Sounds good to me.
All right. Thank you. I'm looking at the reports for 2016. I see that currently we are carrying, close to $2 million in delinquent debt for the agency. Where does that come from in your agency?
Co-Chair, members of the committee, the report would reflect by program where the source of that is. So with the Oregon Business Development Loan Fund, we track the delinquencies with that, with the Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund and the Strategic Reserve Fund. What the report reflects is a history of the delinquencies throughout the fiscal year. So you're seeing that throughout the fiscal year, there are about 24 loans that were delinquent, so they've missed a payment or something along those lines, and we work with the borrowers to collect them and make them current.
A couple of follow-ups, if I may. So you describe this process of working with the delinquencies. Do you have a department, an individual?
We don't.
Somebody with a big stick? What goes on out there?
Co-chairs, members of the committee. So the staff, we have eight staff that are finance officers that service the loans from application through collection. So when a loan payment is missed, basically we have reports that come out on a monthly basis. Our finance officers then contact the borrower directly to see what happened and see what we can do to get them caught up. There are times where the loans default. Business may not have been successful, and at that point, we do continue to work with the borrowers. We begin to work with them just individually. We want to help them go through the liquidation process, get the most for the assets that they have securing the loan, and work to repay them. When we have borrowers that are non-responsive, the process is that we begin working with the Oregon Department of Justice to pursue all the civil remedies available. We can go through the process and have gone through the process of seizing assets with the local sheriffs. We then go to auction with those particular assets, and we liquidate them in as orderly a fashion as we can. There are instances where we do carry some defaulted loans on the book for an extended period of time. The reason for that being is that because we typically have a junior position behind some type of real property or real estate. Usually the best and most affordable way for us to collect on this debt is to wait for the sale of the property. Once there's a transfer, then the state can be made whole at the time. Foreclosure is a difficult process. It's an expensive process, and it's something that we evaluate the cost effectiveness of on a case-by-case basis.
One last follow-up, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to understand the consequence of this process. We've got $2 million in delinquent debt. We've got $200,000 that we actually wrote off as uncollectible. When those kinds of things happen, what happens down the line? What is the consequence? What do we lose in that process?
Co-chair, members of the committee. A couple of things. Obviously, we lose the repayment of the funds back to the program, which would diminish our availability or ability to make new loans in the future. Again, we do our best efforts to collect on these loans and try to get made whole. The one point I would make, the two loans that were charged off in that particular calendar year were the result of a limited duration program that the legislature passed in 2010. It was called the Building Opportunities for Oregon Small Business Today program, or BOOST. And basically, it was designed to provide working capital to distressed companies that had been turned down by two or more private lenders. And this was really a lifeline to some of these programs. And unfortunately, we're going to see a fairly high or higher loss rate with that type of a program. It did sunset in 2013, and any of the funds that weren't made as loans were reverted back to the general fund.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You bet. Representative Meek.
Thank you, Chair. I love the program, and back in the 1990s, I was looking for a source for small micro business funds. And so my question is, I'm a big advocate for small business in our chamber, local chamber in Clackamas County. If a small business was looking for, you know, access, they went to a lender and they couldn't get it, how would they eventually find, you know, Business Oregon? Or would, if they went to a small business development center, would they give you, refer you? My question mainly is, how do we, you know, let people know that there is you are a great resource for that?
Co-chair, members of the committee, we're always looking to improve our outreach and the availability of this program to the community. About 80% of our loans are referred to us by the Small Business Development Center. And I think that Heather Stafford is going to talk a little bit about some of the resources that are going to be made available to help improve the visibility of state and local resources to small businesses that are looking for capital and assistance.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much, Chair.
Representative Reardon.
I love this topic. So, but I'm wondering, and I'm new to a lot of this, so bear with me. I'm not sure I understand why you're in the business of doing this, as opposed to making the funds available, say, to community bank or something like that. How important is it that we have hands-on from people at Business Oregon? So,
Co-chair, Representative Reardon, as to why the department was chosen. These were programs that were established by the legislature in the 90s and 80s. I do believe that one of the intent was to ensure that the program funds were used as intended by the legislature. There are eligibility criteria that we routinely follow. We look to complement the private lenders that are out there, and it's a public resource that's been made available.
One follow-up. And I'm sorry, how many, so you're working with a couple of million dollars, and did I hear that correctly? And how many people are involved with the loan process to watch over this $2 million?
Chair, members of the committee, in total, we have about $50 million in assets that we currently manage.
Okay.
The current portfolio size of the credits is somewhere in the neighborhood of $700 million. When you look at all programs for that, we do have currently 8 finance officers that work much like a commercial lending center in a private bank. Collectively as a group, we have about 250 years of private financial services background and experience.
Okay, all right, thank you.
And you said that your default rate is less than 2%?
Mm-hmm. Co-chair, members of the committee, depending on by program, on the Oregon Business Development Loan Fund, the historical loss rate on that particular program is about 1.5%. On the Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund, we do have a higher loss rate. It's closer to 5 or 6%. And to give you kind of a benchmark and example, the typical default rate and loss rate for a private bank on loans is between 1 and 2%. And it's not uncommon for early stage businesses. One of the next programs we'll talk about actually has private lenders that make loans to these early stage companies. Their loss rate's pretty close to 10% with that program. So we're acting very comparably to the private market, but again, we're taking much higher risk on subprime loans, subprime business loans, if you will, in the same space.
Okay. Cool. Go ahead.
Thank you. So the next two programs that we'll discuss today are our loan insurance programs. We basically have two types of loan insurance programs that we administer. The first one is a capital access program. This too was created by the legislature in 1991, and the purpose of this program is to help private financial institutions make loans to businesses that wouldn't otherwise qualify. With this particular program, it focuses primarily on small businesses. It has a very similar loan size to our Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund. The businesses have a very similar demographic as well. Typically, we're looking at loans of about $50,000 or $60,000. Companies typically have between 2 and 4 employees at the time of application. How this particular program works, when a lender identifies a loan that they feel is riskier than their standard criteria, they can enroll this loan, a loan in this program, by paying a fee. That fee is usually between 3 and 7%, and it's deposited into what's called a loan loss reserve account at the bank. It's controlled by the state. We then match the fee that the borrower and the lender pay, and that helps increase the amount of reserves that are there. Those reserves are saved for the event that a loan does default, and the bank can then submit a claim to get made whole against those reserves. If their loss exceeds the cash reserves, that's their risk. So they still have to do their due diligence when they underwrite the loan. With this program, the bank sets the rates, they administer the terms. Our role is very simple. We determine eligibility. It's a very quick process. Loans like this are enrolled same day or usually no less or no more than 1 or 2 business days, so it's a very quick process. This is a program that's used almost exclusively by community banks. So one point I would like to make is that we've enrolled 23 loans in the last calendar year. If you look back through historical performance of the program, that's down about 50 or 60% over what we normally would do. The reason for this is a couple of different things. One, the primary users of the program are community banks. As we went through the recession and we've come out of it, there were a lot of community banks that closed, and most recently we're seeing a lot of merger and acquisition activity. Larger national banks and regional banks typically look to other programs like the SBA to help provide that kind of credit support. So this is a program, again, community bank friendly. It's a very low, easy, non-regulatory program for them, or not heavily regulated program for them to help meet business needs. Okay, so moving on, our next insurance program is our Credit Enhancement Fund. A little bit different than the Capital Access Program. Instead of insuring a portfolio of loans, we actually insure loans on a case-by-case basis. There usually are, again, two types of loans that we can do. We can do term loans and provide insurance on those and operating lines of credit. The state basically receives applications to this program from our lending and banking partners. We currently have about 30 financial institutions in Oregon that are enrolled in this program. These insurance programs help lenders make loans to businesses that otherwise may not qualify. Usually with this particular program, we're seeing a little bit larger loan size. And historically, we've had a focus on traded sector. Recently, there was some legislation passed that did make this available to retail and service-related industries. But we really haven't seen a concentration shift in the types of companies coming in. We're at about 60% traded sector activity within this program. To be enrolled, the borrower pays a fee. That fee is really based on the term of the insurance. So if we have a short term, maybe a one-year operating line, you'd be at about a point and a quarter. If we looked at a longer term insurance, maybe 10 years on a term loan, you could be paying as much as 2 or 3% depending on the type of project. We can cover up to 80% of the loan. Maximum exposure on a term loan is $2 million, and our maximum exposure on a line of credit is $1.5 million, up to 75% of the line amount. Again, small business focused program. Average company has about 17 employees at the time of application. With this particular program, Business Oregon does underwrite each individual credit. We do work with the lender to establish what we believe are reasonable terms and conditions for the loan. We do secure the loans or ask that the loans are secured with collateral, and that way, in the event of a default, there are assets that can be applied towards the balance. Loss rate with this particular program is historically been right around 2%. And, you know, we work with the lenders to collect on that. In the event of a default, we allow the bank or the financial institution to liquidate the assets and apply that balance towards the loan. We just work with them to ensure that they're doing really their due diligence and maximizing the amount that they're able to recover through that process.
Chair.
Representative Reardon.
Thank you, Chair. Just wondering the form of the business. Are these LLCs, S-Corps, or what form they might be?
Co-chair, members of the committee, Representative Reardon, basically any business type. We can do sole proprietors, we can do corporations, C-Corps, S-Corps, LLCs, partnerships. We can actually even provide guarantees for nonprofits.
Go ahead.
So if it's a sole proprietorship, would you require life insurance or some kind of a package to?
Depending on the project, we may. Life insurance can be a requirement on this particular program or any other when we feel that the owner is very key to the continued operation and success of the. So it is on a case-by-case basis that we look at that.
It seems like a sole proprietorship, it's pretty likely that owners plays a significant role.
Very true, yes.
Okay, thank you.
During our session, this was one of our peak programs. Last year, we approved 36 loans, leveraged about $16 million in capital, and the company's projected to create or retain nearly 500 jobs. 95% of the loans happening outside of Portland, and community banks really are our strongest partners with this particular program. Average loan enrolled was about $458,000. I've got a little bit of an example for you. This is a project that was actually just approved and funded earlier this year. Company's called Hum Kombucha, located out of Bend. Business Oregon, with Hum Kombucha, they have sales in over 5,000 stores nationwide. They needed to expand their production to meet demand for their fermented teas. In 2016, Inc. magazine ranked Hum Kombucha as the 238th fastest growing company in the United States. We were able to partner with Summit Bank in Central Oregon, providing a guarantee on a $1.5 million loan that was part of a $7 million expansion. It's going to help increase production in 50 states and add 10 employees to their business.
That's pretty cool.
Okay, so the last two types of programs that we'll discuss, and these should go a little bit quicker maybe, we'll see, are private activity bonds. Just in a general overview of private activity bonds, these are programs where the role of the state is to determine that projects that apply to these programs meet the eligibility requirements of the federal tax code. The Internal Revenue Code defines what's an eligible project. We help determine that those projects meet it. But as a bond, they're not a general obligation of the state. Unlike a general obligation bond that might be used for bridges or buildings that support public activity, the lender in the particular project bears the entire risk, as would any purchaser of the bonds for the loan that's made to the businesses. The benefit to businesses with these two programs is that it provides lower cost financing to them. As an example, and the reason that that happens is the interest income is tax exempt to the lender when they receive those payments. This really effectively lowers the cost of financing by about 25%. So if a conventional loan was 8%, the business could then obtain a loan for about 6%. And ultimately, that helps lower their cost of obtaining the credit. With the first program, the Industrial Development Bond, this is really to support manufacturing activity. The project size vary between $1 and $10 million. Again, we just worked with the lenders to determine eligibility. A recent project that was funded with this was the Murphy Company in Jackson County. Business Oregon partnered with U.S. Bank to fund a $10 million expansion for the company, and they're an Oregon-based secondary wood products manufacturer. The project funded the acquisition of new equipment and added a new veneer production line. As a result, the company was able to add 65 jobs in White City and Rogue River. And the final program that we have here today is the Aggie Bond Program. Much like the Industrial Development Bond Program, it provides low-cost financing, the difference being the eligibility criteria are related to agricultural property and equipment. The program is capped by the federal tax code at $520,000, so obviously a much smaller project size. Since this program was passed by the legislature in 2013, there's been two bonds that have been funded. We do have one application in process. The couple reasons for limited demand are going to be, one, a low interest rate market, and two, the size cap really doesn't support much in the way of agricultural land purchase. So as I began with in our presentation, there's a couple of key metrics, and we'll just run through some things really quickly and move on. Those metrics, again, are the geographical diversity of the investments that are made. It's important that we reach all corners of the state, that we leverage private capital, we support business expansion and retention, and increase the capacity of these businesses. We do monitor these, and these slides help demonstrate some of that. The first demographic picture, the state of Oregon, shows you roughly the population as a percent of the state by region. And then what we've done is transposed over that a couple of years of historical data showing the distribution of investments and capital in those communities. As you can see, we are serving certain areas of the state at a higher level than the employment, with Eastern Oregon coming at 13% as opposed to the 4% population base. So we are working very closely with communities outside of the I-5 corridor. A little bit less emphasis on businesses with in the Portland metro market area and also the Mid-Valley region, primarily because there's more technical assistance and more financial resources readily available in these communities. That said, we do continue to focus on underserved populations. Our next slide shows the leverage distribution over the six-year period. These funds helped small businesses leverage about $400 million. And again, you can see the distribution across the state. And then finally, job impacts. There are roughly 597 projects helped businesses create or retain nearly 6,000 jobs in our state. In closing, just wanted to basically indicate that there's still more work to be done. We're going to continue to work on helping businesses and underserved communities and populations obtain access to capital. We are going to continue to work with some of the regional angel and venture conferences. We've been partnering with them of late, and it's actually helped raise the profile of some of these programs and also the profile of these conferences within the state. So. And then finally, one of our other primary objectives is to help maintain the credit portfolio standards so that when we do come into a next recession, we do have adequate capital available to help small businesses at that time. And that concludes my presentation.
Question for Mr. Sarris. Thank you very much. Mr. Harder, where are we?
Sure. Chair, committee members, I think as it's probably pretty apparent, John and his team run a very professional and important, have a very professional role for us for both small and expanding businesses. So it's something that our community asks of us, and we complement the private sector pretty well here. So we're pretty proud of the work that his team does around business lending. We're going to switch gears here a bit. So as a reminder, the structure, we've talked about the structure of Business Oregon previously in the agency, and it acknowledges the changing nature of our field. So increasingly, we're seeing projects that incorporate components of business development, infrastructure, as well as innovation. So in previous sections of our presentation over the last couple of days, you've learned about our work related to regional development, retention and expansion, global trade, as well as how we just ended the last day around our infrastructure and business finance programs. The final component of our economic development division we'd like to discuss is our innovation and entrepreneurship team. Investments in innovation and entrepreneurship are not new to the state. Programs such as the Oregon Innovation Council and the Oregon Growth Board have been around in some form for the last decade or so. However, a coordinated state strategy within Business Oregon's purview is relatively new. It is only during this current biennium where we have provided structure and strategy to this body of work. We believe we've made significant progress, but also believe there is much more work for us to do. Our goal at Business Oregon with regards to innovation and entrepreneurship is to excel at three things. The first is industry innovation, which is led by the Oregon Innovation Council and the newly formed Oregon Manufacturing Innovation Center. The second is access to capital, which complement our lending programs with oversight and strategic direction from the Oregon Growth Board. And the third is statewide support for small business growth, where we take a partnership approach alongside small business development centers, higher education, and local communities to encourage entrepreneurship in our more rural areas of the state. I would like to turn it over to Heather Stafford, who manages our innovation and entrepreneurship team, to walk through some of our programs in more detail. One reminder, you will be in phase two of our presentation getting a more detailed overview of Oregon Inc. and perhaps some of these other programs.
Thank you. Good afternoon, co-chairs Johnson and Gomberg, acting chair Monroe. For the record, my name is Heather Stafford. I'm the manager for the Innovation and Entrepreneurship team at Business Oregon. And I'd like to share four examples of critical work that we're leading to build a thriving support network where small businesses can thrive, grow, and scale here in Oregon. They are the Oregon Innovation Council, Oregon Growth Board, the Rural Opportunities Initiative, and our Oregon Manufacturing Innovation Center. We manage other important programs as well, but due to limited time today, I'm going to just give a very high overview of these four and, as Dr. Harder said, revisit some of those projects in more detail during phase two. We know that small businesses are the drivers of the Oregon economy, of resilient communities, and also are the future creators of state revenue. As Dr. Harder outlined, our unit, sometimes referred to as INE, you will hear, or Innovation Entrepreneurship, is structured to promote a healthy environment for businesses. We focus this in three areas: on invention, access to capital, and business development. So I'll start today with the Oregon Innovation Council, or Oregon Inc. This is a 20-member governor-appointed board, which is made up of service providers, industry leaders, businesses, investors from all around the state. Oregon Inc. launched 10 years ago to commercialize emerging technology technologies born out of science and research. And as you may know, there's a treacherous valley of death for early stage science and technology companies. Especially, they have a long road to commercialization compared to software startups, and there's very limited assistance to bring their world-changing inventions to the marketplace. And as you know, manufacturing is particularly important for the Oregon economy. Oregon Inc.'s package was originally funded in 2007 for $26 million. It's been a POP presented to you every biennium since. And in 2015, Oregon Inc. was included in Business Oregon's base budget at $17.9 million. In addition to this base budget funding shift, the council also recognized two added components that required some strategic planning. The first one, as Director Harder mentioned, was in 2015, the establishment of this team within Business Oregon, enabling this agency to provide a cohesive statewide strategy and find efficiencies with existing innovation and entrepreneurship programs and resources, as well as identify gaps and opportunities. The second was, after 10 years, the innovation landscape in Oregon does look significantly different than it did in 2007. So remember, the founding of Oregon Inc. was before there were iPhones, Facebook, Uber, 3D printers, and what are now the 70-plus incubators and accelerators that call Oregon home. The world looks very different today. So I'd like to share some of the impact that Oregon Inc.'s created over the past 10 years. Since 2007, Oregon Inc.'s signature research centers and industry initiatives have supported 190 early-stage invention companies. These companies generated $630 million in follow-on funding from federal and private investors. The state has invested almost $95 million in Oregon Inc. since that time, which represents a 6-to-1 leverage on state dollars. 400 firms have accessed vital shared labs through the signature research centers in partnership with Oregon's research universities. And the many core services that the signature research centers have provided include industry cluster building, research and development support, labs and facility support, founder mentoring, business development, intern support, and strengthening innovation and investor connections all around the world. Investments like this do take time to pay off, and Oregon Inc.'s founders and the legislature knew this and made a bet on the future. So at the 10-year mark, these are exciting times for Oregon Inc. We're starting to see the payoff of those early investments in the jobs numbers now as well. In the past four-year period, there were 376 jobs created with Oregon Inc., and now, just in the past year alone, Oregon Inc. created 326 jobs. So in other words, Oregon Inc. created almost as many jobs last year as the previous 4 years combined. So this enormous spike illustrates the long-term returns on these innovation investments. And on top of that, the average wage for an Oregon Inc. job is $78,000 a year. It's important to note that all these numbers are verified, and we do not allow initiatives to self-report. We also do not include indirect jobs. Also in fiscal year 2016, Oregon Inc. companies earned $23.9 million in revenue, which is a new metric we're tracking. And remember, the signature research centers generally begin their support with a company before they have even a team or certainly revenue. So to continue to build this upward trend in high-impact industries and high-wage jobs, we're bringing forward the following recommendations from the Council for the 2017-19 biennium. I'm going to stay very high on this because we're going to dive way into this in phase two. But broadly, the Signature Research Centers will be focused on continuing their work to build the pipeline of companies who qualify for commercialization funding. They will also identify and manage high-impact opportunity projects. These projects grow Oregon industry clusters through discrete public-private projects that gain us a competitive advantage in target industries. The all-important commercialization or gap funding that bridges the valley of death for technology-based companies will be centrally managed and accessible to qualified companies growing out of any of the signature research centers. Finally, the council moved to adopt a federal grant support program that assists inventors in preparing for very competitive federal research grants. Business Oregon piloted this program last biennium, and companies leveraged an amazing 40-to-1 ratio of incoming federal dollars to state support dollars. So in the 2017-19 biennium, Oregon Inc. proposes the budget features these four distinct but highly dependent investment areas totaling the $17.7 million that's reflected in the governor's and the co-chair's budget.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A quick question, right there on the bottom right, it says red arrow down reduction 2000. What does that mean?
Co-chair, committee members, Representative Meek, as part of our, given the current budget situation, we had to look at cuts throughout the organization. This being a lottery funded program, we are reducing it. We have recommended a reduction there in the governor's budget.
A follow-up?
Follow-up.
Is it about 10, 12, 15%? Do you have any idea what you're looking at?
Last year, I believe it was, I guess current service level would be 18.6. So this is recommending about $800,000 or $900,000 less.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
As long as we've taken this little break, in the interest of full disclosure, I have served on the audit committee for Oregon Inc. Practically since its inception.
I think so.
And I can attest to the fact that the audit committee has scrutinized these initiatives. It has had a private sector chair with considerable expertise in entrepreneurship, venture funding, venture capital funding, and they're pretty rigorous audit processes.
Thank you, Chair
Please
Dawson.
Continue.
So as with all of our programs, Oregon Inc. has intentionally sought to create impact for more parts of the state than just the urban core. And today there's even more exciting opportunities in advanced manufacturing and natural resources and in active lifestyle, which is where the majority of the council's next support in the biennium will be targeted. Oregon Inc. is approaching innovation with an industry focus that can make our state more resilient, more independent, and more globally competitive, and also bring higher wage jobs and widen to a widening geography and population base in the state. We must keep investing in emerging technologies that are born out of science and research. It's important to note that these technologies get increasingly harder to silo with every coming year and every new innovation. Take drones, for example. Drones incorporate hardware, software, sensors, GIS mapping, data analytics, robotics, artificial intelligence, and you couple all of the elements that go into the drone with all the possible industry applications that the drone has in construction and agriculture, firefighting, forestry, entertainment, film and video, and you start to get the picture that this example alone underscores the need for distinct but highly dependent investment to take a look at these much more cohesively as a state. Now, to fuel these innovations, companies do need capital, and our primary strategic body for increasing access to capital is the Oregon Growth Board. It was established as a board in 2012 to make key investments that also create an economic impact for the state of Oregon. This dedicated board also works to address capital gaps that are experienced by entrepreneurs in Oregon, and as capital availability at various stages and for certain industries is a common reason that we do lose companies to other states. There are, in 2014 also, Business Oregon assumed the role and the sole responsibility for the Growth Board from the Treasury. The Oregon Growth Account, so there are two different investment funds with two different missions that the Oregon Growth Board manages, and I'll try and be clear. If you have any questions, please ask. The Oregon Growth Account is charged with generating returns from venture capital investments and to open up the availability of this VC capital to companies in Oregon. Equity investments can be made with funds whose headquarters are out of state, but who make investments into Oregon companies. This account receives 1.8% of lottery dollars, or approximately $10 million a year, and provides returns to the Education Stability Fund. The account has invested a little over $112 million since the year 2000. 181 Oregon businesses earned follow-on investments of just over $264 million because of the Growth Board investments in outside funds. Those companies contributed $9.5 million in state taxes in just 2015 alone, and aggregate wages for employees that received funding was $150 million. The Oregon Growth Fund is the second fund under management and is a local impact fund, meaning it prioritizes growing the resident capital base for the state of Oregon. It also focuses on filling capital gaps for underrepresented populations, underrepresented industries, and geographies around the state. Investments may be loans or equity and are 100% invested in Oregon capital vehicles. And in 2016, the Growth Fund was an investor in all of the regional angel conferences in Bend, Eugene, Portland, and Roseburg. Also, the new Social Impact Fund in Bend, the Inclusive Startup Fund in Portland, and a variety of CDFIs, including Craft3, MISO, and Community Lending Works. Historically, this has been funded out of discretionary lottery dollars, but we are working with Treasurer Reed for a more permanent funding solution for this important growth fund. To build the pipeline of great Oregon companies that are ready for investment, we also do work on the ecosystem or the network at large. And we know that innovation can come from anywhere and that small businesses should have access to the same high-quality support services no matter who they are or where they live. And one of our agency POPs is the Rural Opportunities Initiative, or ROI. This was formerly known as READY, or the Rural Entrepreneurship Development Initiative in the governor's budget. Working both with urban and rural partners and participating in over 22 entrepreneur town halls all around Oregon, we consolidated what we heard from entrepreneurs into four primary challenges that inhibit their ability to get the help that they need. And these are especially pronounced in rural Oregon. One is inefficient network. Often agencies and service providers are overlapping or sometimes competing. Invisible services. So technical support services are often isolated in offices or dispersed all over a city and very difficult to find for companies. Insufficient resources. So rural communities often lack certain expertise locally, and they often have limited connectivity to where those resources are. And inequitable systems. Services are not equally accessible to tribal entrepreneurs, bilingual businesses, communities of color, women, and youth. So to address these challenges, we've been working with four rural communities over the past year to pilot the Rural Opportunities Initiative to uncover grassroots strategies to achieve their vision for centralized entrepreneurship support capacity. And this looks very different in each community because each community has a very different economy, different local resources, a different economic base, and different industry priorities.
Ms. Stafford, I'm going to interrupt you and ask, of the four communities that are up there, Klamath Falls, Coos Bay, Baker City, and LeGrand, what were the characteristics of those places that caused them to be desirable as you piloted this program?
Great question, Chair Johnson, members of the committee. We had a very competitive process. We issued an RFP, and we're looking for collaborative bids from communities. We received 24 applications, and they fell into two primary categories. The first was groups that did a service provider. They had a program that they thought worked really well, and they wanted to take it out to their more rural neighbors and deliver that. The other half of those...
Could you stop and give an example?
Sure. So we received applications from many who did business development programs or had an incubator, an accelerator that was technically not rural, but they wanted to sort of drive around and deliver pub talks and deliver classes to their rural neighbors because they had some core competency in that that they wanted to share.
Let me try to understand this. Are these private not-for-profits? Are they units of government? Are they functions of MPOs? Those are all too small communities to have. What was their profile, and how did you vet them to make sure that they were strong enough to stand up to do this work?
Great question, Chair Johnson and members of the committee. It was a very challenging process to decide. There were a lot of really interesting collaborative applications and ideas out there. Ultimately, we went with the communities who already had some prioritization of entrepreneurship in a plan, and they had a collaborative together that
let's,
was...
Let's take this out of 100,000 feet. Tell me why you picked Baker City.
Okay.
I'm just lost in kind of the rhetoric.
Great.
What was it about Baker City that was compelling?
Great. Chair and members of the committee, Baker City was compelling. They had already received USDA funding to start a Center for Entrepreneurship. They had traction. They had a partner who had a model that they were establishing, and they had a piece of real estate that the Chamber of Commerce, the local nonprofit, and a Portland nonprofit were coming together to build a center. In fact, they...
Who were they?
So the Portland partner was Hatch Innovation, and the local partner was the NEODD in Northeast Oregon, their economic development district.
Lose the acronyms. Economic
Development District in Northeast Oregon was a partner. There was a real estate owner who had a place on Main Street that they were going to discount and commit to a center for entrepreneurship. And they, the partners, there were some private partners as well.
So how do you ensure the integrity of the players? I mean, if I'm marketing a piece of real estate in downtown Baker City and suddenly I see the state of Oregon coming with a check that I know is going to be good, or at least I think is going to be good, how do you vet the qualifications, and I'm certainly not casting aspersions, but I think for all of us, in looking at advancing this program, we'd like to know, how do these folks get picked, and who drives it? The Portland not-for-profit operating in Baker City, are they welcome? Have they been embraced by city leadership? Are they... There are enough problems in Portland. How come you've got a Portland not-for-profit cruising Baker City?
Yes, Chair Johnson and members of the committee, great questions indeed. And the reason that this has been a pilot in the last year is because we've been working to answer these questions. The four different communities look very different. Baker City had so much traction, and they had Hatch Innovation working there for 3 years. They've had the USDA, Rural Development Initiatives, and various other people.
What's Hatch Innovation do?
They're an incubator, a social incubator, providing, you know, education to companies all over the state.
Who are they?
They're a nonprofit. They're just a nonprofit incubator, accelerator, who's developed a fairly sustainable model. That's always where these tend to get tripped up, is that they can build them for a little while, but the model hasn't been there to be able to sustain this capacity locally, financially. So that's where we're working on that model. Where they don't need to continually ask for additional funding.
Chairman, committee members, if you might add, Hatch Innovation would be an example of what, when you hear the term incubator or accelerator, these often provide very specialized mentoring and resources to help entrepreneurs find capital. So curriculum, they're working with small businesses on their small business plans. They're connecting the founders to other founders so that they can kind of do shared learning. So these are very common around the state.
Let me just tell you, and I don't mean to equate the two, so don't see any subtext in this, but we sat right in the same hearing room and heard about a not-for-profit in Portland that is coaching job seekers on self-esteem. I asked what the value of the contract was, and the principal in the company couldn't tell me. I think that's lethal. I mean, either it was a failure to disclose when asked a direct question, or she didn't know, and I was taken aback by it. And so what I'm trying to figure out is, with the state of Oregon passing through as much money as we're passing through, what are the performance metrics that you look at Hatch for? And have you scrubbed them to see that their corporate books are in order? And they don't, I just come from testifying on a debt collection bill, that they don't owe the state of Oregon any money. Or will Hatch reappear in other cities? Are they now making this part of their base budget? I'm just trying to figure out how you qualify your partners. The economic development districts, I understand that. That's a function of the federal government. Chambers, I get that. City councils, I get that. But I'm just a little surprised at a Portland not-for-profit appearing in Baker City, and I wonder what level of due diligence was done. It just, it's an intellectual curiosity for me. I'm not drawing any value judgment on it at all.
Great question, Chair Johnson and members of the committee. I'm happy to share our due diligence process with those four in the pilot, as well as the more than 25 communities that we've been working with who are prioritizing this capacity, and how we begin to approach that once this program continues.
Let me ask you one more. The more you talk, the more I have questions. You've got 25 communities that are all in the beauty pageant right now. You're only going to add another four, right?
We are working with four now. We will add another 5 to 8 communities.
Okay.
Should we receive the
so 25
funding.
Minus 8, you've got a lot of people that are all dressed up with no place to go. What kind of rigor are you putting them through if they're not going to go the distance? I've seen way too many attempts at trying to entice small communities that are so desperate for jobs and so desperate for attention. And I'm just curious, are you putting them through paces with no realistic chance that they're going to be considered?
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, absolutely not. I think we are approaching this from a grassroots, locally driven perspective. So this isn't us coming in from on high as government and dictating and having and dictating how they approach this work. And we're looking for collaboratives that are organized, that have local match and funding, and that have the ability to leverage federal and philanthropic funding as well. So the level of organization and local leadership it takes to get to that point is our bar, and I'm happy to communicate what goes into that as far as metrics.
One more. Is there a set standard so that Baker City had to come with a one-to-one match, or are you flexible in considering the match? Or
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, for the pilot, we went with creative solutions and with local leadership as a priority because we were testing what models, and we're testing the connectivity also between centers. So for the four centers, were intentionally two of them in Northeast Oregon and two of them in Southwest Oregon so that we could get the virtual connectivity piece worked out to see if they could share best practices and centers for excellence. For example, if I move on a little bit, I have two examples of where we're doing this in these four communities. In two of them, however, Baker City actually opened Hatch Baker. It's open now. If you go to Baker City on Main Street, you can walk in and see what it looks like and engage with the staff there.
Who built the building and whose money built Hatch Baker?
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, it was a leased building, and that's why the real estate developer who owns the building is a partner because he wanted to see this capacity locally. They're challenging several assumptions, I think, that people make about rural, which is, one, that a town of 10,000 couldn't attract paying companies to co-locate in a co-working space like this. And before they even opened on October 31st, people were peering in the windows, and they sold three annual desks, before even opening. They've sold one since, and they are on their way to membership that will make the center sustainable within the year. Also, they're gathering a cohort for a Spanish language program, and that is with Adelante Mujeres. They have, in Forest Grove, they have a Spanish-speaking program that trains young companies, early companies, to get better at their business development. So they're going to be piloting that in Baker City, so we're testing that virtual component of delivering expertise from Forest Grove into Baker City so that they can provide that resource locally. In Coos Bay, there are 12 local partners who provide, who've all signed letters of intent to co-locate and find a downtown building to build a center for entrepreneurship in downtown Coos Bay. They're leveraging local investments with state and federal support to build this capacity, and the vision is that all 12 co-locate on one floor and they build a center for entrepreneurship where companies can co-work and innovate and get mentoring in the same building. The Coos Bay is calling this effort the REEF, or Rural Entrepreneurship Ecosystem Framework. That's their words, and they envision it as their one-stop center for business. In addition to those two pilots, we're working with several other rural communities around the state. They've expressed interest, and this will be an ongoing process that that will be much more solidified, and we can go into detail in phase two, if that's of interest.
I can tell you right now it will be.
I imagine so. Thank you. Finally, I'd like to overview an exciting new project that embodies what next-generation innovation capacity can look like in Oregon manufacturing. The Oregon Manufacturing Innovation Center, or OMIC, is a public-private collaborative effort to build a shared industry R&D center that works to solve the most pressing issues in advanced metals manufacturing. The governor has allocated and dedicated funding in the 2017-19 budget for this effort. Not only does OMIC look to become the only research center of its kind in the United States, but it will, and to attract the greatest global manufacturing companies to innovate here, but there's also a training component on campus for hands-on training and apprenticeships, so training the workforce of tomorrow on the latest innovations in manufacturing. The OMIC Innovation District in Scappoose has more than 400 acres available to build out the most advanced R&D center in the world. It's modeled from a very impressive Advanced Manufacturing Research Center, or AMRC, in Sheffield, UK, and also partners closely with them.
I've not heard too much about that. Do you have any more information?
Chair Johnson. Sure.
Let me make this easy for you, Ms. Stafford. On the night of the 14th, you are invited to come to a reception to learn everything you possibly wanted to know about OMIC.
I'll be there. Thank you.
Cool. The whole legislature's invited.
Wonderful. For now, I'd like to share some milestones with this project that's moving really at lightning speed. The OMIC R&D facility and land have been purchased and are occupied and being built. Research projects are imminent. OMIC R&D Master Membership Agreement is finalized with commitments from Boeing and six other industry firms, as well as Oregon Tech, Portland State University, Oregon State University, and Portland Community College. PCC is working to acquire 20 acres of land and an option for 20 additional acres in Columbia County to build a 25,000 square foot training facility. That's a $9.4 million commitment on their part. The OMIC Innovation District expansion plan is looking at future R&D facilities, and new operations is underway. Much interest is coming in from global companies that I'm sure Senator Johnson can share with you more closely.
I will just add that at this point we have commitments of about, and when I say we, it happens to be located in Columbia County, but we have commitments approaching $12 million of donated equipment. The reason that folks are so interested in participating in providing this donated equipment is that if their equipment becomes the processing platform on which pieces for the next generation of Boeing flying machines are made, their bit that's made on that equipment will be in an airplane for the next 25 years. It is so difficult to get widgets through the FAA certification that if this device is made on a particular machine and it is accepted into the Boeing supply chain, it will continue to be a Boeing specified part. Boeing had subbed out a lot of their work on the Dreamliner and found that to not be very acceptable in terms of timeliness and quality control, and they're bringing a lot more in-house. This facility in Columbia County supports 1,600 Oregonians that work at the Boeing machine plant in Gresham. And Boeing is now, with $350 billion worth of back orders, trying to turn out equipment faster, greener, better. And they're making their own units compete within the Boeing family. So in order to keep Gresham competitive, the R&D that will happen at OMIC will feed that plant with an idea of keeping Boeing the premier airplane manufacturer in the world.
Thank you, Senator Johnson, and members of the committee. This is truly a unique opportunity for the state of Oregon, and it's all hands on deck here at Business Oregon to support this effort.
I would just add that Adrian Allen, who started the AMRC, is going to be at the reception on the 14th if you'd like the opportunity to meet him. He took property that was valueless. It was a brownfield, and turned it into the most valuable real estate in the UK outside of the dirt that Parliament sits on. They run $1 billion of economic activity through that center. And in one of life's little ironies, Adrian called me from the UK the other day. He almost ended up going personally broke trying to get Boeing to pay attention to a methodology he had for cutting titanium, and Boeing has just now announced that they're going to build a building on his campus, and it will have hands across the ocean support for the Gresham facility, but Boeing will be breaking ground on the AMRC. If you want to Google AMRC, you'll get an idea of why it is that even the most conservative governments in the UK did not cut the AMRC when they were looking at massive budget reductions. And if we can replicate this in the United States, this will have regional, if not national implications. It's a very big deal. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Chair. As you know, Fenway's coming next summer. Is there something to see here, or will there be something to see next summer that would be
I've just made a note. I don't know if I can answer that right now, but I'm sure we can have a breakout session. We did a breakout session at the Business Summit, and Adrian flew over from the UK to be there for it. It was the head of intellectual property for Boeing, the president of PCC, Adrian, and me, and we had an opportunity to tell this story to 1,200 Oregonians. So absolutely we can figure out something with Penn.
Okay,
PCC has not yet broken ground. Getting the property inside the UGB was the culmination of 10 years of effort, and it's now in the annexation process. So hopefully we'll have two very fancy construction sites.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. My final slide is our team manager, also a number. Oh, there's your image. this is the actual facility that's been purchased by Oregon Tech and exists now and has growing activity inside of it in Columbia County. So moving on to our partner programs, our team manages a number of important partnerships with the SBDC network, with GCAP and OMEP. We work to align their scopes of work, with reporting and metrics more strategically with all of their unique services that they offer. For the SBDCs, we our business finance team and our business development team partner very closely with them on capital access and business development, and they're our primary partner for business development referrals. With GCAP, which is Government Contract Assistance Program, we partner with for wraparound services for certified companies. We also, they're our primary resource for government-related referrals, and OMEP is the Oregon Manufacturing Extension Partnership, which we administer their contract, and we work with them extensively on manufacturing and lean processes. And that's all the slides I have today, and that's all I have time to share with you, unfortunately. I look forward to spending more time on these initiatives in phase two and diving in a little bit deeper and answering some more specific questions about each of them. It's really an honor to do this work in the great state of Oregon, and I look forward to next time I get to present to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, any questions of Ms. Stafford? Thank you. Mr. Harder.
Chair, committee members, if you don't mind, I'd like to call up Brian Rogers, who is Executive Director of the Oregon Arts Commission and Cultural Trust, to provide an overview of his division and team.
Thank you very much. If you'd sign in, please.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Johnson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian Rogers, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Arts Commission and the Oregon Cultural Trust, and we are known as the Arts and Cultural Department within Business Oregon. The Arts Commission became a part of Business Oregon in 1993 in recognition of the expanding role arts play in the broader social, economic, and educational arenas of Oregon communities. In 2003, the Oregon Legislature moved the operations of the Oregon Cultural Trust to the Arts Commission, streamlining operations and making use of the Commission's expertise in grant-making, arts and cultural information, and community and cultural development. The Arts Commission and Cultural Trust have two separate boards and two separate staff, with two exceptions, myself and the communication manager are shared between the two agencies. Both the boards and the staff review our mission and goals in relationship to our programs and services. The Arts Commission provides leadership, funding, and arts programming throughout the state in grants with special initiatives and services. Nine commissioners appointed by the governor determine the arts needs and establish policies for public support of the arts. And the mission of the Arts Commission is to enhance the quality of life for all Oregonians through the arts by stimulating creativity, leadership, and economic vitality. The Arts Commission is entering its 50th anniversary and was created shortly after the National Endowment for the Arts was established.
Mr. Rogers, let's go back to your provide statewide grant funding. And I know that's the Arts Commission, but I'm going to take the Cultural Trust, the Arts Commission, and the Heritage folks all in a unit. I have heard some criticism that there have not been a lot of grants east of the Cascades. And in some cases, grants had been made and then were withdrawn or not funded in the next year when nothing particularly had changed. There's a fair amount of angst in Central Oregon, particularly, and I would assume in Eastern Oregon about that. Could you explain why the choice was made to think that Oregon ended at the Cascades?
Chair Johnson and members of the committee, we're actually going through a very in-depth process right now. We call it our diversity, equity, and inclusion process that overlays into our strategic plan. We are very mindful of our reach across the state, and in fact, the highest percentage of per capita funding is in the region of the northeast corner of the state. And our funding programs, we're also with the Cultural Trust, which I'll talk about in a second, we have county and tribal coalitions that every county and just about all the tribes receive funding from the Cultural Trust to make local regional awards.
That's statutory?
Yes.
Okay. So let me be less oblique. How come you decided to axe the High Desert Museum?
Thank you, Chair Johnson and members of the committee. Just to be really clear, they are receiving support in other programs. What the program that they were questioning was about was the operating support program. And the operating support program in our guidelines states that organizations need to be arts organizations, that arts needs to be the core function of the organization. It was determined by a committee of the commission that the High Desert Museum did not have arts as the core activity. It was a more of an ecological survey of the High Desert area.
But you had previously funded them, and it seems sort of an abrupt change of direction. Did you tell the grantee that this rather dramatic change was going to occur so that they could prepare for it?
Chair Johnson and members of the committee, yes, there was communication back and forth with the High Desert Museum. I got here about almost 3 years ago, and prior to that, the High Desert Museum was allowed into the category along with, I think, two other organizations. And as part of the ongoing operations, the commission reviews organizations in every category. And they had determined that they wanted to do a more in-depth research on the High Desert Museum and received a lot of information from them, and in the end determined that they were not eligible for that category.
Determined based on some objective criteria, or was this totally subjective grant-making on the part of your committee?
Well, they received a lot of information from the High Desert Museum.
I'll tell you what, I've made my point. Let's take this offline.
Okay.
I think some of us on this panel need proof that you all acknowledge that there's the rest of Oregon, and whether it is a list of your Eastern and Central Oregon grantees or it's a statement of your objective criteria under which organizations can apply. Mm-hmm. But I'd be happy to have you pass that through the professional staff and make it available to the committee. Senator Hansel.
Would this also be, for lack of a better term, the small arts and cultural grant program? Would that be under you, or am I off base on what that's about?
The chair and members of the committee, yes, we do have a small arts program. We call it a small operating support grant program, and it's for organizations under $150,000 operating budget. And it's a very streamlined process. The category that Chair Johnson was mentioning was for organizations over $150,000, a different kind of review.
Senator Hansel.
I would like to have some additional, because we've received some issues with that as well, I believe.
Yes.
In the small grants program, what's a typical grant?
Oh, they're Chair Johnson, members of the committee, they're about $1,200 each.
I would be very curious to know how much real estate, time, energy, money you chew up administering a $1,200 grant.
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, it's a very, very streamlined process. It's just a couple page application that we review very quickly with a committee of the commission. Again, the larger grants we make, we have citizen involvement. We have peer review panels comprised of individuals from across the state that represent the diversity of Oregon.
Are all the beneficiaries 501c3s?
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, yes, they are.
I think we're going to want some additional detail on that program. Of the $1,200 grants in the small grants program, what's the total amount available to re-grant or to pass out to grantees?
Chair Johnson's a member of the committee. It varies between the Arts Commission and the Cultural Trust. Combined, I can get you that number tomorrow. I'm not able to pull it off the top of my head.
I'd like it. Please. Okay. The whole committee would. Please continue.
Thank you, Chair. Currently, we have 9 different grant programs with the Arts Commission that respond to arts organizations, community projects, and artists. In the last biennium, we awarded over 600 grants across the state. We also host the annual Arts Summit to provide valuable information and services to artists and arts leaders. In addition,
let's stop right there just for a second. Of those 600 grants, what degree of follow-up do you do? If I'm a 501c3 and I apply for a $1,200 grant that I'm going to buy new seats for my lobby, what degree of follow-through do you do?
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, each organization is required to submit a final report, which we review internally to make sure that that matches what they propose to do.
Okay, that must take some staff time, too.
Chair Johnson, member of the committee, yes, it does take time.
Okay, and then you said all of your grantees of these 600 are 501c3s. You're not making grants to individual artists.
Chair Johnson, member of the committee. Yes, I should make clear that, yeah, we do make individual artist grants.
Judged on what criteria? That, you know, Mr. Harder is a landscape painter, and he does beautiful landscapes, and Mr. Cirrus is a clay artist. How do you decide that one has worthy art and the other maybe not worthy of a grant?
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, I don't make that decision. It's made by a peer review panel. So members of the arts community, let's say painting community, would come together and adjudicate applications submitted and then rank those applications based on how well the artist is doing in our fellowship program creatively and artistically.
That seems very labor-intensive.
Chair Johnson, member of the committee, it does take some time, but we take it very seriously.
Okay. Thank you. Please continue.
The Oregon Cultural Trust is unique. No other state has a program like the Cultural Trust. It, like Oregon's Bottle Bill and Public Beaches, reflects our citizens' values. Created in 2002 by the Oregon Legislature, the Cultural Trust serves as a testimony to how culture contributes to our famous quality of life. No other state provides 100% tax credit to inspire cultural giving and then annually redistributes these funds to every single county statewide. The trust has a board of directors and is comprised of 11 at-large members and two legislative members, one from the House and one from the Senate. And the Oregon Cultural Trust mission is to lead Oregon in cultivating, growing, and valuing culture as an integral part of communities. And we do this by inspiring Oregonians to invest in a permanent fund that provides annual grants to cultural organizations. The Cultural Trust encourages Oregonians to donate to one or more of the 1,450 cultural nonprofits in the state, and then donate a matching amount to the Cultural Trust, up to $500 per individual and $1,000 for couples filing jointly, and $2,500 for C-class corporations. And the matching amount to the Cultural Trust can then be claimed as a tax credit. Combined, the Arts Commission and Cultural Trust support and encourage Oregon's quality of life, education, and key investments in our state's cultural assets. In fiscal year 2016, the Arts Commission supported 400 arts and cultural organizations and programs. The 164 organizations that receive operating support employed 1,946 people. Our operating support plays a key role in helping job retention at these organizations.
Could you bring us a summary of the 164 and the amounts that they received?
Chair,
this is limited to operations, correct?
Yes.
You smiled. Am I asking for an onerous amount of data collection?
Chair Johnson and members of the committee, no, it's yes.
Okay. Thank you.
The Arts Division's support of arts and cultural organizations enables communities to attract business development and retention through direct support of community and quality of life. The annual combined attendance and participation of individuals in nonprofit arts organizations and cultural activities is measured at 4.9 million unique experiences. The Arts Commission funding enables organizations to leverage public and private support. In the last biennium, the Arts Commission invested $4.7 million in general funds, federal support, and other funds.
Is it possible for a sophisticated grant seeker to be funded both by the Arts Commission and by the Cultural Trust?
Chair Johnson and members of the committee, yes, it is.
Could you bring us a list?
Yes, I can.
Thank you.
Since 2000, the Arts Commission has received...
Let me ask you one more question. Forgive me. What do you do if you've got frequent flyers that are double-dipping in both of the, that's my terminology, in both the Arts Commission and the Cultural Trust? Are others not funded while you've got some that are able to access support from both the Arts Commission and the Cultural Trust? Do you do anything to ensure against that so that someone gets a chance to be funded rather than a more sophisticated grant seeker having multiple chances?
Chair Johnson and members of the committee, we have layers of different kinds of programs and access to arts and cultural funding. The Arts Commission is focused on arts organizations and arts program. the Cultural Trust, and it's 50 years old. The Cultural Trust, about 15 years old, is, in statute, we have a direct grant making program. We also have the county and tribal coalitions, and then we also fund the five cultural partners.
Right. I've read the statute. What I'm trying to figure out is that some, it appears from your testimony, are able to have multiple grants and be funded by both the Arts Commission and the Cultural Trust, I presume to the exclusion of others, because I would assume, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there is more need and desire and demand than there is available resources to fund everyone.
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, yes, funding for nonprofits, and especially cultural nonprofits, is competitive. And our grant-making programs between the Cultural Trust and the Arts Commission are separate, but we do have some overlap in those that access funding for both.
Okay, but you'll provide the professional staff a list so that we know who's been funded out of both sources.
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, yes, we will.
Thank you. Please continue.
Since 2000, the Arts Commission has received $11 million in National Endowment for the Arts funding, which was matched by $25.8 million in state funding. Annually, the NEA, National Endowment for the Arts, and the Arts Commission funding for the arts has leveraged more than $238 million in local and regional support to Oregon arts organizations. The Arts Commission supports and provides a high level of technical assistance to organizations that conduct artist residencies in the K-12 setting. Last year, over 71,200 students were directly involved in arts learning projects, with an additional 1 million youth reached. Community-based arts and cultural organizations provide learning experiences for all Oregonians.
But you're not providing that technical assistance. You're giving it to educator professionals in the schools, or do you have a cadre of people that actually do the hands-on technical assistance?
Chair Johnson, the member of the committee. We have a program called Arts Learning that enables arts organizations to insert into school settings artists to do arts residencies. And we also provide our coordinator for the Arts Learning program also provides technical assistance to those organizations to strategize about how best to do that. And she's very much on a national level as well. In fact, our Poetry Out Loud statewide event is this Saturday. It's our state regional event, and we'll send on the winner to that to the federal level competition. Our arts and learning coordinator was the first person in the country to incorporate deaf students in their sign language interpretation. So we're very innovative in how we approach our arts learning category. Community-based arts and cultural organizations provide learning experiences for all Oregonians, and our programs address diverse populations in the state, including people with learning disabilities and adjudicated youth. The Arts Commission also manages the state's Percent for Art program, which engages community dialogue and brings artwork to public spaces. Since the statewide Percent for Art statute was enacted in 1979, nearly 300 new build and renovation capital projects have been served. Since 2002, 120 public art projects were completed with a total budget of $17.8 million, and currently we are managing 19 projects with a total of $4.3 million. Last year, the Cultural Trust received $4.5 million from over 9,100 donors. Of the $4.5 million donated, 60% was allocated to grants programs, services, and administration. The remaining 40% was placed in a permanent fund for future generations. The Trust has four direct grant programs categories that, in last biennium, funded 100 projects across the state, and we also provided significant funding to our five statewide cultural partners: the Arts Commission, Oregon Humanities, the Heritage Commission, Historical Society, and the State Historic Preservation Office. Additionally, as I mentioned before, we do fund the 45 county and tribal cultural coalitions, and each coalition receives a block grant from the Cultural Trust, and they are led by county-based volunteers and local funding priorities they develop plans, and each block grant is re-granted annually. And last year, we funded about 450 local projects across the state and in the coalition service regions. The trust license plate sales average about $13,000 a year, raising $374,000 for promoting and supporting culture statewide. And I'd just like to briefly share a couple of our stories that illustrate the impact of the Arts Commission and the Cultural Trust.
Please, we're running out of time.
Oregon's Washington County will soon add to its vibrant high-technology profile Bag and Baggage Productions, a once-touring company troupe that blossomed into an acclaimed fixture in the Hillsborough Venetian Theater, recently began construction on a state-of-the-art facility that will boast some of the state's most advanced performance technology. A regular recipient of the operating support funds from the Oregon Arts Commission, Bag and Baggage was founded in 2005 and quickly grew, gaining a reputation for artistic quality, affordability, and a very quirky sense of humor. They soon found loyal patrons in the Hillsborough area and decided to put down theatrical roots. The new home for Bag and Baggage Productions will feature a 360-degree digital projection technology using multiple projectors to create whole worlds of movement, color, light as part of the performance. This will create opportunities to partner with existing technology industries in Washington County to create set designs that are both highly theatrical and environmentally sustainable. Many consider the restoration of the historic Liberty Theater to be the spark that ignited Astoria's remarkable renaissance. For years, the once elegant theater, home to silent movies and vaudeville performances, leaked, rotted, and tilted with neglect until a group of community leaders said enough. Since 1998, about $9 million in public and private support has helped the Liberty get back to its days of grandeur. Last year, 273 days at the Liberty were programmed with over 35,000 people in a town of 10,000. And we helped support that with a small but meaningful grant from the Cultural Trust. And over the last couple of years, the Trust has granted the Liberty Theater over $36,000. The last example, teens will soon have a dedicated learning space at the Dallas-Wasco County Public Library. And this is funded by the Oregon Cultural Trust, and the new space will include a digital media lab for teen programming room specifically designed for students from grades 6 through 12. Among the educational investments will be new programming materials and digital media equipment, including this green screen, which obviously was painted by some of the teens in the area, and they also got some paint on themselves. The total project cost was $122,000. The trust grant was $40,000, which was the second largest funding source for the project. The largest grant was $60,000 from Google, which paid for the digital media lab. In closing, for the biennium, the combined budget for the Arts Commission and the Cultural Trust is $15.9 million. $10.1 million in other funds includes the trust donations, which is the majority of the support, license plate revenue, percent for art administrative allocation, which is 10% of the 1% of total construction costs, and other funders, including the Ford Family Foundation and the Oregon Community Foundation. The majority of general funds are used by the Arts Commission for grant programs, services to the field, and administration. The federal funding is from the National Endowment for the Arts. Just a little bit of national context, we are entering our 50th anniversary, and the Oregon Arts Commission per capita funding is 51 cents per person, which ranks us at 33rd in the country. The national average is $1.13 per person. General funds are critical to the Arts Commission to continue to support our diversity of arts organizations, artists, arts learning, educational programs, community arts projects, and we also are required to match the federal National Endowment for the Arts to continue to receive that vital support. The 12% reduction, which is about $530,000 to the Arts Commission General Fund, would reduce the operating support grant program by over 30%, and thereby reducing the same percentage to the 150 operating support recipients. Operating support is the most difficult revenue to secure for nonprofit arts organizations, And the Arts Commission is one of the very few that supports operating costs in this category, supports staff positions in general administration with reductions in general funding. Organizations could very well see reductions in staff levels as well as reduction of program and services. With a 12% reduction, we would also eliminate or severely cut back on our Arts Summit, which is the annual statewide assembling of arts leaders and organizational managers.
Thank you. We're starting to lose committee members. I think this is your last slide, is it not?
This is it, yes.
Yes. Colleagues, any questions? Thank you very much for your presentation. Mr. Bender, would you give us a preview of tomorrow?
Tomorrow, the agency will continue on a review of their operations and administration area. Then there will be a report from on Oregon Film and Video Office. DAS will talk about the governor's budget, and public testimony is also scheduled.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, anything for the good of the order? Thank you for your patience. We're adjourned.